Buenas tardes, good evening. Thank you for being with us today on such a sunny day. And I would also like to welcome those who are watching us at the cyberspace. So good evening to them as well. Well, as you know, in this year's seminar, we've been dealing mainly with the future. So we had lectures on part of political scientists, experts in geopolitics, lectures on climate change, climate activism, and we will keep dealing with similar subjects in the weeks to come. Today we're going to change our perspective radically. We are going to focus more on the past, but we're also going to switch experts for thinkers, or if you prefer, social or hard scientists for representatives of the humanities. So our guests today will be Mary Beard, as you all know, a historian, and Antonio Muñoz Molina, a writer. So let me first introduce them briefly, and then we'll start our debate. So Mary Beard is professor of classics, or has been, in Cambridge and in King's College in London. She is widely known for her books on Rome particularly, but also on Greece. She's also very well known and became very popular because of all those documentaries that you've been doing for the BBC, not just on ancient Rome. I remember the one together with Simon Schama on civilizations, right? And what I think almost everyone, you know, at least, you know, academics have at least once had a look at a blog in the TLS, you know, where you deal with all kinds of subjects. Well, she has many awards. I just want to mention the Princess of Asturias Prize because it's a Spanish prize, but she also has the Order of the British Empire. Is that right? So, yeah, and much other. And so one of the books of hers that had most impact was the one SPQR, Senatus Populusque Romanus, A History of Ancient Rome. Well, recently readers of Prospect magazine voted her as the world's seventh most significant thinker. She was behind Pope Francis, you know, this has to be said. So she is immensely popular, and we can also say an academic star. To give an example, you know, I recently bought a book by Richard Cohen called Making History, The Storytellers Who Shaped the Past. And I ordered the book because it was advertised like this, from Herodotus and Thucydides to Mary Beard. So you're in great company, Mary. Well, in a profile of her in The Guardian, one could read things like this, and I quote, "One reason Beard is so widely beloved is that her interventions in public life, whether one agrees with her or not, offer an alternative mode of discourse, one that people are hungry of. A position that is serious and tough in argument, but friendly and humorous in manner, and one that, at a time where disagreements quickly become shrill and abusive, insists in dialogue." Thank you very much for coming, Mary. It's a real pleasure.
Thank you.
Antonio Muñoz Molina, of course, you all know him. He's probably the best Spanish writer alive. He's the author of numerous novels, but also essays and hundreds, probably thousands, newspaper articles, right? His works have been translated into more than 20 languages. I'm going to say some of the titles in English. The Polish Horse Rider, Sepharad, A Manuscript of Ashes, In the Night of Time, Beatus Ille, well, that's not in English, but, you know. It's and we all, probably most of us, read also his weekly articles in El País, you know, every Saturday. He has also an engagement with public issues, not just in his articles in El País, but also in some of his books. I remember particularly the one that Everything That Was Solid, which was quite an interesting criticism of Spain in general, just Spanish politics. The situation in Spain that led to the economic crisis in the end. So we thought of bringing Muñoz Molina in dialogue with Mary Bird because we believed he fits perfectly in a subject like this. In his writing, memory plays a crucial role in shaping identity and understanding history. So his characters often grapple with memories of past traumas or experiences that continue to affect them in their present. These memories can create a sense of displacement and fragmentation, but also provide a way for individuals to understand their place in the world. Thus, memory, history, and identity are intertwined and constantly evolving, and they are shaped by both individual and collective experiences. I don't know, Antonio, if you would agree with this, but in any case, we thank you very much. Thank you very much also for coming. Just a sec. Because I want to let you talk now, so I want to keep silent as soon as possible. So what I would like to underline is that our two guests are what we may call memory keepers or explorers of the past. And I think that's what they both have in common, from different perspectives, of course, but that's what they have in common. And so our intention is to make a vivid dialogue and so that the moderator doesn't have to intervene very much. And but I would like to pose a couple of questions, so very broad questions. Let's start with the first, and I would start quoting that so often abused phrase by Hartley. So, the past is a foreign country. They do different things there. By that it is meant that it can never be fully known nor understood. But in both your cases, it should seem to be the opposite. It's the country that you somehow also inhabit. How do you deal with that? Having one foot in the past and one in the present. And in any case, is it really so foreign? Mary, let's start with you.
I'm very glad you said that it was an abused phrase, the past is foreign
exactly.
country. Students often quote it, and you say, have you ever read the novel by L.P. Hartley that is starts? And they say, no. And you say, actually, it's about sexual exploitation, class prejudice, almost everything else horrible that you can think of. And they think, the past is a foreign country. How romantic that is, right? Not for Hartley. I think
it's quite to the point, Don't you think? Start with that.
Well, in a way, I think it is a good question to start with, because for me it just sums up everything I don't think I understand about doing history. Really, I think the past is foreign and it's familiar, and it's the kind of image I have of myself when I think about particularly Roman history, but it could be anywhere, is that you're kind of walking along a tightrope. It's very hard to balance. And you look down on one side, underneath you, to the past, and people are doing very ordinary things. They're eating, they're going to the lavatory, they're being just like us. You look down on the other side, and they're completely wild, utterly different, and incomprehensible. So there's that kind of sense that why the past is interesting is because it's both foreign and familiar. It would be very, very boring if it was just familiar, but it would also be pretty boring if it was just different, right? It's the fact that it's both different and the same. And that, just before I pass over to Antonio, is, I think, made hugely more complicated by the fact that the only voice that comes out of the past is our own. You know, the past isn't actually speaking to us. We are making the past speak. So we are constructing a dialogue which is familiar and different, but the only people who are actually in control of this is us. So we're inventing the past as we want, and we invent it to be foreign and familiar, I think, which is why we can write novels, I suppose, let alone history.
Thank you, Antonio.
Well, this is the beauty of it. This is a lesson that we can learn. No? I mean, both the difference and the similarities. No? Because on the one hand, you think of people who were painting the caves 20,000 years ago, they are similar to us. Their brains are exactly the same. You know? And the worries and their... And you wonder what kind of stories did they tell themselves, no? Because they were painting these beautiful walls, no? These beautiful and living animals. There was a... You can find there a tradition, a pictorial tradition, no? You see that there is a... This is a survival society where there are a number of people who are selected to do something as unpractical as painting, no? Or as making music or things like that, no? So you see, it's so familiar, but at the same time, it's so absolutely strange. And this is a lesson for us in the present, no? Because for us, it's very difficult to be able to see clearly the familiar, because the familiar is too close to us. Yeah. And it's also very difficult to understand the difference, no? So when you study history, in my experience, what you learn is how similar they are to us, and at the same time, how different. And it helps you look at yourself and at your own time and other people, because it makes you see things, present things, from the light of the past. I'll give you an example. Most of my writing and of my attitude to life and to public issues is connected to my personal experience as a Spaniard who was born in the 50s. No? If you were a Spaniard born in the 50s in a small province, in a peasant family, you were not born in the 50s in the 20th century. You were born long before.
Me too.
So now, and then you grow up and you live in a completely different country, in a completely different time. I mean, you have a personal experience of the past as a foreign country. And it gives you a perspective on the present, because you learn to appreciate differences that otherwise would not be noticed. Because, for example, the difference, I mean, the way society in Spain has evolved. No? Me and you, and some people here, have personal memories of an absolutely backward country. Close, ultra-Catholic, where men had absolute power over women, where working people were not allowed to have a better life. No, everything was so different. And then a few years later, everything was absolutely new. And now Spain is in many aspects, Spain is a far advanced country, even more advanced than many other countries. So in my own lifetime, I've lived through a span of maybe one century, from agricultural backward society to a contemporary postmodern society. So it gives you a sense of history, a sense of how things change, and how fast they can change, and how easy it is to forget how different they were only 20 or 30 years ago. You know, this is something that I have learned, that this is part of my. You might call it my consciousness as a person, as a citizen, no? How things change, how fast, no?
Yeah, but there always seems to be a present from which we look at the past, right? And this present somehow introduces a certain bias in the way we read the past, you know, if you allow me this expression or not.
I'm not sure it's a bias. I mean, I think all history is bias, in a way. I mean, yeah. You know, again, students are always taught to come to university, and what they've done at high school is to say, you must not be biased, right? And I think it takes about 3 years to convince them that the aim is to be biased, but in an intelligent way. And I think that it's in that, it really is in that conversation that you have about, well, as Antonio said, about the difficulty of understanding in your own head what history has been in your lifetime. And I think that alters if you're, I mean, it's different for a woman from a man. If I think of the very rural part of the United Kingdom in which I grew up, and you think about the, you know, what a woman's life was like then, I can tell you it wasn't 100 years ago, it was more like 300 years ago. But it's a question of seeing how your biases and how the present can make you see different things about the past, while at the same time, your construction of the past makes you see different things about the present. I think the past ought to be, or the way we construct it, ought to be very unsettling. It ought to make us feel very uncomfortable. It also ought to make us think, what will it be like when we're the past? Right?
Yes.
You know, now you can sit here and we can look at Victorian 19th century UK and think, how benighted. Why are we going to be benighted? So it's a good way of sort of, it's cultural humility is involved, I think, in doing history.
Yeah,
actually, how am I going to appear? Right? Is it going to be our statues that are going to be pulled down in a few hundred years?
Yeah, sure.
I wonder.
And I think there's also something that you learn from studying the past is how entrenched and unconscious biases are. People at the end of the 19th century were absolutely sure that in most cases women were not equal to men, or people in the colonies or colored people were different. This was not held by far-right politicians. It was stated by scientists and historians. So when you learn how biases were acting and yet invisible, it helps you understand or get a suspicion that maybe we, us, ourselves, have different bias.
Yeah.
And this is something absolutely disturbing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because when you see how biased most, even the best intentioned people were learning history or studying science or geography or whatever, one century ago, how rational, intelligent, good intentioned people. I mean, I'm not talking about extremists, no?
Mm-hmm.
People like Darwin, for example, no? The cleverest people were so biased in many senses, no? So you wonder, what are our biases nowadays? No? What is what we are not looking at? What is what we are not seeing? Same as in the 80s, only in the 80s, when I started publishing books, no? There were the first conferences of writers I attended. I was never aware that there were almost no women in them.
Yeah.
You know?
You were unaware of it.
Yeah. So I'm not talking about the 18th century.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the 80s, the late 80s, no? There was new generation of writers, to which I belong to, and we were sure that we were right-wing people, left-wing people, that we
progressive
were... And then when I look back to the pictures at that time, I see, it's only men. Now this is so blatantly visible, and at the same time it was, but at the time was almost invisible, at least for men.
Yeah. I still would like a little bit to stick up for the idea of bias, you know, on the grounds that if we were absolutely neutral and unbiased about everything, we would have very little to talk about. But I see what you mean, and I think that you can follow it round and round, can't you? Because I think one of the exciting things about teaching Roman history or Greek history, is to say to people, students, look, this is a slave culture. There is no single more important thing you can know about ancient Rome than it's a culture based on slavery. But let's get clear that their culture based on slavery did not correlate with skin colour. This was we are before the transatlantic slave trade. And so you imagine if you're a Roman and you think about a slave, you probably think about a red-headed German than anything else.
Yeah.
And then the student will say, "Oh, so they were nicer than they were better than us, were they? they didn't have racism, like a big crime they didn't have." And you think, so you're going to let the Romans off the hook? You're going to praise the Romans when they're actually horrible in all kinds of ways that we're not, right? But are they good or better, or what kind of evaluation do you have? Because their prejudices don't match ours.
Yeah.
And I think it's liberating to think about a culture whose prejudices don't match ours.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean they didn't have any prejudices. And it certainly doesn't mean, as people who've watched television programmes often say to me, "Oh, you'd really love to go back to ancient Rome, wouldn't you?" And you say, "God, what a nightmare. Nightmare."
Good luck for you.
"Only if I can have the return ticket same day, please."
Okay. I wanted to put another point.
Excuse me. I would like to add something. Something that you can learn also from the study of history is to become aware of how immensely different life can be and the sense of life. Because when we read historical novels or things like that, no, or films, no, everything becomes more or less familiar. But when you read history in the way Mary tells history, no, when she goes to how people actually lived, no, you become aware of how immensely strange it would be for us to spend a minute,
that's right,
5 minutes there, 5 minutes in Pompeii.
Yeah, for example. Terrible, a nightmare. And I really hate it, and I know the programme has failed, when people tweet in and say, "Oh, wasn't that marvellous? It just shows that human nature doesn't change, does it?" Just like anything, you've missed the whole point of the programme, my dear.
Yeah,
both does and it doesn't.
Yeah, I want to face another subject which we have somehow touched upon, you know, which is the case of you know, this, I don't know, it's not really an accusation, but, you know, it's really a movement, you know, that tries to decolonize academia and reassess the role of the Western classics and Western historical narratives. So it has a lot to do with, I'm not going to evolve very much, but I think you know perfectly what I allude to. I think it has a lot to do with, you know, what it's called the woke conception of history, you know, this woke or progressivist intention of trying to make a revision of our whole history, trying to point on how unjust it was, how racist, how sexist, how Western, and so the our Western perspective, it's really based on the perception of one of the civilizations, right? And you know what I don't like about it, I think it's necessary, you know, to look back and see what was the condition of women, or what was the condition of the exploited or masses or whatever. But you know what I don't like about it is this need to moralize history. To say, so this was the right thing to do, that was unworthy. Because morals are okay, but moralizing implies, you know, that you point to the other and state simply that it's the other is unworthy somehow, right? So How would you say about it?
Well, I'm going to confess to being a little bit woke, actually. and instead of the word woke, I use the synonym for woke, actually, woken up, is enlightened.
Enlightened,
right?
Yeah.
And I think I'm a little bit enlightened. I hope I am. But I think that, I mean, I see exactly your point, Fernando, and I think it is too easy to judge the past and judge it badly just because it's not like us. But I also think that if you're a historian, you have to have some moral compass. And I've just finished a new book on Roman emperors. And Roman emperors, you know, don't have a particularly good press in the modern world. And some of the things that happened under their watch are things that I think we find very difficult, like, you know, how do we judge gladiatorial display and the killing of people for pleasure? And I found myself, when I came to the end of the book, you know, in a sense, siding more with you than I thought. And I thought, how, on the one hand, it would be wrong to let the Romans get away with this just because they lived 2,000 years ago.
Yeah.
Oh, it's all right. They're not like us because they're very much in the past, and people in the past did really different things. But at the same time, I thought, so as a historian with a moral compass, how do I judge it? You know, how do I say, as most people do now, oh, it really is very hard for us to take gladiatorial combat, you know, and then just pass on as if, you know, nothing had happened and you've kind of genuflected to it. When, you know, should I be judging this? Is it irresponsible to judge it? To say, look at that cruelty, how do we explain it? Or is it irresponsible not to judge it? And I think that is, no, that is one of the big issues about how you do history. It's one of the big issues that, I mean, I mentioned statues coming down just a little while ago. And there was a very famous toppling of a statue in the UK in the middle of COVID, a statue of a philanthropist called Edward Colston, who it had long been known was involved in profiting from the slave trade. And eventually the people of Bristol took this into their own hands. They pulled it down, the statue, and they threw it in the river. And I watched this on my iPhone, and I thought, great, you know, eventually someone has said, this guy is not a hero. It took me about 5 minutes to think, but how could he have done what he did? You know, here he is, 17th century. How could he have profited in the way he did? The answer, I think, came pretty quickly, which was that he didn't have anything to do with the ships or the boats. He was sitting in London. He was doing the bookkeeping. It was just commodities. And he could do it because it was a very long time away, distance away. And then I thought, and I'm looking at this on my iPhone, and where is my iPhone made? In what conditions? Conditions, you might say, of modern slavery. Why can I happily use my iPhone? It's because the people who make it are, like Colston's slaves, a very, very long way away. And there, I think, I thought, there is no firm ground, woke or not, to stand on. Yeah.
Yes. It's interesting what you say about your iPhone, because I recently wrote a piece about a book that just came out in the US called Cobalt Red, which is a research on how cobalt, who is so important for the new energies, for new green energy. I mean, the new green revolution is based mostly on cobalt, which is a mine in terrible conditions with child labor and terrible exploitation. And we are all benefited from it. So what I think about the woke thing, I'm sure that we need to learn about people who were silenced or suppressed in the past, no? I think, for example, in peasant, in my home region, for example, no? I mean, history, contemporary history of Spain, people like working class people, women, children of working class, are absolutely invisible, no? I have a beautiful memoir written by a friend of my father's who was with him at school prior to the war, no? So and this man, in his 80s, he suddenly decided to write his memoirs. This had been a peasant. He had lived through the whole of contemporary Spanish history from the point of view and from the point of a working person, no? So he was a peasant. He left the countryside. He emigrated to Catalonia to work in an industrial company. So he had this kind of life, no? And much like my father and so many people like this, no? And in his 80s, he decided to write his memoirs, no? And he gave it to me. And it was so moving because it was a testimony of something that is never told, no? Yeah. What was life like for people like that, no? What was like to be a child during the Civil War? What was like to have to leave school at 8 and go to work to a farm, no? So we need to broaden our oversight of history, no? To include so many people who have been ignored. My problem is with some attitude of condescension towards the past, no? Yeah. Condescension and a kind of will to erase things that are disturbing for you. So you are and you are denying something that history teaches you a lot about, which is complexity. Yes. Things are extremely complex. Yeah. I'll give you an example that worries me. For example, one of the people I most admire is Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement in the 60s in the US. I mean, this is the noblest endeavors ever attempted by human beings, no? Mm. And he was... So, but then you think of it, and it turns out that these people were extremely homophobic.
Yeah, they were.
And yeah. Male chauvinists.
Yes.
I mean, Rosa Parks was pushed aside. Yes. So, yeah. How do you judge this?
Yeah. Yeah.
No heroes.
No. Do you dismiss Martin Luther King?
That's right. Yeah.
Do you dismiss the civil rights movement?
Yeah. I mean, a reverse example would be eugenics. Yeah. Because we all know now what happened and the appalling things that were done in the name of eugenics. If you go back to the 1880s, what you find is people were beginning to wonder how scientifically you could have a better world. Yeah. And one of the things they started to explore was the beginnings of what we would call eugenics.
Yeah, absolutely.
They were not doing it in order to eradicate people they didn't like. There was no kind of Hitlerian project. They were trying to think how the human race might improve. Yeah. And yet we now know that where that led was something of which we fundamentally disagree.
And our most admired Scandinavian social democrats were very were very in favor of eugenics.
Yeah.
In
a sense. So there isn't a decent British left-wing politician in the 1880s who doesn't think eugenics has got a lot to be said for it.
But if I may intervene so briefly, don't you think there's a difference between Cicero having slaves?
Excuse me,
Cicero
having
slaves to Thomas Jefferson having slaves? So because there seems to be something we call enlightenment, right? So and then once we started thinking, you know, and stating that humans are equal by nature and that kind of stuff, and Jefferson was, you know, had read, you know, all the basic books in order to be capable of understanding what the enlightenment meant. And nevertheless, he had slaves. But Cicero, I mean, he never wrote Kant. Red Kant, or
lucky him.
No. And you know, he participated in a culture where, you know, it was such a matter of fact, you know, right? So I think that We must put some limits. You know, when we look at the past, you know, this can be better understood than this other one thing, don't you think?
But there's also the question of seeing identity, not just similarity, but identity between institutions to which we give the same name. And, you know, I think most people who work on any period of history before the Middle Ages would say there was no society in the ancient Mediterranean world, the ancient world probably, that did not have forms of unfree labour. But they were universal. And so you say, well, fine. Does that, you know, there's your problem. Does that mean we can judge, we can let Cicero off because he couldn't think differently, whereas Jefferson has got all the advantages? Or should we actually be saying what enabled those forms of unfree labour to continue, even amongst people who had every capacity for seeing what was going on? And I think we're back in the historical judgment problem. It's irresponsible to judge, and it's irresponsible not to judge.
It's also, we're talking about statues, and I remember the one of Hume in Edinburgh, because now we are dealing here with the Enlightenment, no? I remember this beautiful statue of Hume in Edinburgh, no? And you know that many people have demanded to bring the statue down, because it happens that it seems that Hume had some interest in a slave owning company or slave trading or something like that, no? So how far do we go? Because thanks to people like Hume, we have the very ideas that allow us to be against slavery.
That's right. Yeah, exactly.
So, what do we do? So, do we throw Hume at the same to the river as well as?
Yeah, but to a woke activist, he would have a stain, right? I mean, he would be signaled, you know, as being someone, you know, who should be censored somehow or should be put aside. Don't you think?
I mean, I find myself walking around central London and looking at all these old white men on pedestals, most of whom I have never heard of. And I find myself thinking, putting two fingers up to them and saying, you never thought I should have the vote, did you? You know, but I won, right? Now, and I find that hugely reassuring. You know, they're lost. They're there, so I can know they lost. And I think that's good. But the argument against that point of view is that I'm someone who has won. I have power. I can go and I can say, up yours, you lost. Whereas there are the descendants of slaves who are still looking at statues of people who represent the power that still oppresses them. I've escaped, but other people haven't. And, you know, so it's easy for me to say, silly old man, stay there on your pedestal.
And on top of that, pigeons are shitting on your head all the time.
Yes. Paul. Paul, you. I mean, you know, pedestals are a very, very dangerous place to be. Yeah. And I think that is actually why we need them, right?
Yeah, well, let's make a slight change of subjects, because I would like to face the problem with ranking cultures or, you know, attaching more value to some or cultures than others, right? So even the word classic, etymologically, it's from classicus, you know, belonging to the highest class, right? So when we talk about the classics, we talk about a certain canon, right? So that we can distinguish between real cultural achievements on the one hand and not so good cultural achievements. So that doesn't mean necessarily that some cultures have lesser worth than others. It's simply that, you know, it's unavoidable. So even the UNESCO, when they have to decide, you know, what should be World Heritage monuments or whatever, I mean, they have to choose. They have to make a ranking, right? So they have to decide which buildings really deserve it and what other buildings don't. So, and I think this is interesting because somehow, I don't want to insist on the woke stuff, right? But somehow I think this is mixed up with a different issue, which is to speak of cultures as being incommensurable somehow, right? So we can, on the one hand, we can think of cultures being in, you know, with capital C and in singular, so everyone contributes, no matter from what culture specifically, and then cultures in the plural, which has to do with different identities, right? So, but nowadays, I think this has become mixed up. So we can, it's difficult to differentiate, so the claims of certain cultures, you know, to be incorporated into those rankings. So to have the right also have their classics, or to be among the classics, right? Would you agree on...
Classics is a horrible term in some ways, although I'm proud to call myself a classicist. I am proud to call myself a classicist. It's often attacked for exactly the reason that you say, Fernando, that the idea of attributing the adjective classic to culture or literature or whatever does come from a second century AD Roman writer who used the ranking of social class to put some literature into a higher and more elite category than the proletariat literature. Now, I think I'm just going to say one thing in defense of the ancients. That is the only time it is used just once in ancient literature like that. And even the guy who uses it is very unclear how he is using it. So, but it got very quickly taken up by everybody else, I think unaware of the social and political elite that went with it. I mean, I think my problem is how you can see and accept different forms of judgment, both within and outside your own culture, without somehow establishing that as a kind of, you know, world rank order, a kind of Eurovision Song Contest version, you know, of culture. And we know we do it inside culture. We don't even have to kind of think about whether we think, you know, a pop magazine is as good as Shakespeare. You know, look at tour guides. You know, take your guide to Spain, for example, and what you'll discover is that every tour guide will say, I mean, in the book, it'll give 3 stars to a mountain, and it'll never give any stars to a plane, you know? Yeah. So mountains are sexy and important and culturally valued. Flatland isn't, right? Now, the point about that is it doesn't matter very much. It does start to matter if you say, well, I don't actually think that Indian literature is really quite as good as Spanish literature. You know, how do we compare Lorca and... And there I only think, you know, the only resource we've got is education. Education and writing and talking and encouraging people to explore, not minding terribly much if they end up preferring one thing to another, but at least knowing about something else. And I think that the problem in the UK, and I think this is where post-colonial courses in English language literature, for example, have made a huge difference. You actually say, look, guys, there is a whole load of writing in English coming from the continent of Africa. Please notice it. You don't have to like it. You don't even have to buy it. But you're damn well going to know it exists. And I think what one's doing, the best one can do, is combat that cultural blindness, as if there was no culture in the world.
Absolutely. There is something you remember, there was a scandal that when Saul Bellow, famously in the 70s, no? There was this, the cultural debate was starting, the cultural wars were starting at the time, no? And he rhetorically asked, well, yes, who is the Dostoevsky of the Zulu? And there was this very clever African writer who said, the Dostoevsky of the Zulu is Dostoevsky.
Very good, yeah.
Brilliant.
I mean, it all depends. You use the term culture as a general and abstract thing, it becomes a problem in itself, no? I prefer to think of the different ways cultural traditions or cultural artifacts are used, no? To what use are they put to, no? And I think, for example, the way Montaigne brought to his own time the Roman literary tradition, Lucretius and Seneca, for example, how Montaigne created modern consciousness through his reading, through his interpretation of the classics, no? Of some classics he was very fond of, no? The way he used Lucretius and to defend freedom of speech, for example, or freedom of spirit, no? Or the way he learned from Seneca. And Montaigne, by the way, was also the first one who wrote essays considering the value of other cultures. You remember his wonderful essay on cannibals.
On cannibals, yeah, that's great.
He had this wonderful chance to meet some American Indian kings or whatever that came to France, no? And he had a chance to talk to them, no? And he wrote something wonderful about cannibals, no? He said, the difference between cannibals and us is that they kill people and they eat them. We burn them and we let them to go to... we don't take advantage of...
But we kill them as well.
We don't eat them. We simply burn them at the stake.
Yeah.
We don't make food out of them, no? So... And I think, for example, and the way some post-colonial writers have used the Western classic tradition. I was thinking when I was coming here about how Derek Walcott, no?
Yeah.
Who came from the Antilles, from a small island, St. Lucia, who came from a family of slaves, slave people, no? How he appropriated the cultural heritage of the classics. Yeah. I mean, he wrote this wonderful long poem, Omeros, no?
Yeah.
At a time when Western European intellectuals were somehow dismissing or forgetting or not paying attention to the epic poem, it was Derek Walcott, the one who brought it back from the past, no? Yeah. And made it relevant to the present, no? So there's far more to culture than you can think, no?
Yeah. Exactly, Do you want to add... anything about
no, I, you know, absolutely agree. And but you can see that kind of cultural porousness in all kinds of cases, both in terms of gender. I mean, one of the biggest things in Anglo-American literature recently has been the rewriting of Greek mythology from a woman's point of view. But you can also see Ralph Ellison doing, black writer doing it with Virgil. You got Walcott with Homer. I mean, actually, this is, it is both undermining our certainties, but also providing these, making these poems new again.
Yeah, making it alive, no?
Yeah.
And relevant to the present, no? Yeah. That's why this term of cultural appropriation, no, is so annoying. No?
Because, it's very annoying.
No, it's great,
Because every culture...
Is there anything that is not... cultural appropriation at some level or other? No?
Well, Virgil was doing it to Homer, for a start, so it's got a long history.
Yeah. Okay, we don't have much time, so because we want the public to put some questions. I had one one question to each of you, but I think I'll skip it and just make a last question, at least from... here from the floor, and it has to do with the title of this seminar. And so, can we learn from the past? Or,
yeah, I mean, I think that or Antonio almost sought to answer that almost head on earlier. I mean, I think if you say, can we learn from the past, i.e., are there lessons waiting for us to kind of take off the shelf? Then the answer is no. I mean, the past doesn't have those kind of lessons for us. All problems are always, you know, differently configured, more complex than we could ever realise. Can the past make us think differently about our own assumptions, about the way we set about thinking about our problems? Then every time, you know? I mean, if you say, basically, you know, there is no culture in the world that comes into being without being dependent on the past, then it's got to talk to the past, and it's got to learn that sometimes its own self-righteousness, quite a lot of wokery is self-righteousness, I will give you that, that it kind of shakes us out of ourselves. It's, you know, the past is not a kind of comforting set of traditions. It's dangerous, discomforting, and a bit scary. And, you know, it's not for the faint-hearted, looking at the past. But it makes a difference to how you look at the present and how you look at the future, and you're all the time remembered that one day you're going to be the past too.
Yes. But you may wonder, can we learn from something other than the past? I mean, yeah. This is the only we have to go on.
Yeah. the past experience was yesterday. You know?
We have, this is the only thing we have. We have experience, no? And I think that we can. We have to do is to get a sense of a historical awareness, no? I mean, a critical sense of the past, no? How difficult it is to come to a reliable knowledge about the past, how problematic the past is, no? In many senses, because we don't have that much information, and we have far less information than we think we have, no?
No? Yeah.
So it gives you a critical attitude, especially towards these many ideologies which are based on the manipulation and the lies about the past. I mean, people are killed by the hundreds of thousands in the name of history, in the name of false history. No, people were killed in the Balkans in the 90s because of some battle that took place in the 14th century.
In Kosovo, yes.
And now, right now, people are being killed in Ukraine because of this fantasy about historical unity between Russia and Ukraine and whatever. So, one of the uses of the study of history is to take a critical approach, to be able to dismantle this legend, these murderous versions of history. No, I mean, you think about how the past was, the interpretation of the past that was taught at Spanish schools when we were children. No, Spain was supposedly to be the avant-garde of a Christian civilization, and we had been at war with the Muslims and then with the Reds in the Civil War. No, so Spanish past was a permanent struggle of Christianity against heresy. So this was what we were taught at school.
We were always taught that these famous Elizabethan men who went off in ships were explorers, and it took me about 30 years to discover they were pirates, that no one said.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's take some questions from the audience. You can put them in Spanish if you want, so maybe...
It's a question over there. So raise hand.
Oh, yeah.
Ask Antonio and Mary your opinion of concepts such as democratic memory laws.
Pardon, I can hear you well.
Yeah, your opinion, and this is particularly pertinent to Spain, but can be applied to other countries. What do you think of democratic memory laws?
Well, this has it's a serious question, no? Very much connected to what we're talking about, no? It is difficult to establish a version, official version of the past by law, no? Mm-hmm. I think that Spanish society has still a lot to do in order to reach a balanced and non-biased version of our common history, no? We have been too much in our interpretation of history, our vision of history has too much influenced by our political positions, no? But this has happened at the level of the political debate, because, as you know, historians more or less have reached some kind of agreement about a general agreement of what the past was like, no? The problem, I think, is to try to bring the information, the history of Spain, of contemporary Spain, out of the political, not debate, but out of the political strife, you know? We have to accept. There was an American or British historian, I don't remember the name now, who said, if you feel proud when you are studying history, if the study of history makes you feel proud, you are not studying history. So we all, people, the progressives and the conservatives and all of us, we had to accept that the history of Spain in the 20th century, the history of the Republic, of the Civil War, needs to be seen with an effort to be as clear as possible, as balanced and as fair as possible. We have, what worries me about the term memory, democratic memory, is that memory is personal, and whereas history is impersonal. So do we need a democratic memory, or do we need a serious history, a serious teaching of history? On the one hand, we have to tackle the issue of so many crimes and so many murders and so many executions that were and so many injustices that were done in Spain during the dictatorship, during Franco's dictatorship. We should have honored many people who fought against the dictatorship and who fought during the war, etc. But at the same time, we should agree on something that many people who fought the war agreed upon, that the differences that brought about the war had to be overcome by reconciliation. This is something that was said famously by Manuel Azaña, the President of the Republic, in 1938, no? So we had to overcome this kind of struggle between the famously called two Spains, which for me do not exist, had never existed, no? So we had to make the effort to bring to the social and civil debate the things that the historians have been long teaching us. I mean, many historians, when people said in the early 2000s that in Spain there was this famous pact of silence, no? That the war had not been discussed of research, that was a lie. As you know, as you perfectly know, many wonderful books have been written about the war from many points of view, no? But this kind of more or less academic agreement among historians, no, has not translated into the public debate. Or even in the last 20 years, things have changed for the worse. Because I think that history has become far more a partisan issue than it was not many years before. No? So I agree that you have to have to honor the people who have suffered, and not only those on the one side, but those who were unfairly, who were murdered during the war, for example, here in Madrid, no? by the Republican side. So we have to kind of get a national agreement, no, in the best possible, in the widest possible sense, because all the necessary elements are already in place. No, not much more information is going to come about. No, we know mostly, we know almost perfectly well what happened. What happened during the war, what happened during the dictatorship. So we have to reach a compromise. No? As you know, this is an interesting word that doesn't mean the same thing in English as in Spanish. No?
Yeah. And the situation in Britain is inevitably different in all kinds of respects, but I think that some of the blinkers are similar. And that came out recently in the radio and television and newspaper reporting of the difficulties of President Macron, where BBC was repeatedly telling us that we had to understand that the French had a much more kind of radical and violent political history than we did, and that there was such thing as, remember the French Revolution, you know, they kill kings and things like this. Never was it mentioned that, you know, we've had quite good record, you know, bad record in killing kings. We killed George the First. We've had civil wars too. It's just we call them different things in order to disguise it. So we talk about the Wars of the Roses between the Lancastrians and the Yorkists. It was a civil war, ladies and gentlemen, but we don't like to call it that. And so our kind of, the British embeddedness of that miscognition. You know, just like, you know, another one would be that we won the Second World War, which is, you know, a claim reenacted every Christmas with 1940s war movies. You know, that, and you have different, there are different circumstances, there's different legislative or cultural framework. But I think that you know, the Brits could do with opening their eyes to what they did to their monarchs and not just be slightly sniffy about the French.
Yeah, in Spain, we talk when we talk about the Napoleonic invasion, we call it the War of Independence, and the British call it the Peninsula Wars.
Names are absolutely crucially important. You know, in my field, the go back to the 5th century BC, it's the Persian War. Actually, it's the war between the Greeks and the Persians. All right?
Okay, more questions?
Yeah, there's a lady over there.
Yeah, up there. She's hidden up there.
Hi, thank you. Thank you very much for giving me some voice. I have two questions. One is, what can we learn from the past to face the challenges of the present? Because nowadays we do have many challenges. We do have, a war in Europe. We still have Guantanamo, and we still have slavery. So what can we learn from the past to challenge the present? This is the first question. And the second is, sometimes, or most of the times, we try to find the solution in education. And my question is, who educates? The family, the school, the academy, the tribe, the social media? Because nowadays we do have, what are the results of fake news. Poor British people vote for the Brexit. So these are my two questions. Thank you very much.
Well,
I'll take the first one and then leave Antonio to have the second. In a sense, this is going back to a formulation that you just made that I'm sure I'm going to borrow later, Antonio. You know, that if the past can't, you know, what else have we got if the past can't teach us something? I think that what the past interestingly and creatively understood helps you see is one very simple thing, which is that mostly this is much more complex than it's presented. And if somehow professional historians, writers, academics, teachers could make complexity something that we see is the part of the solution to the problem, not just another way of saying it can't be solved, then I think we've got a chance of getting a bit further. It's the kind of, this is all terribly simple line, but I think all historians in some ways tend rightly to attack, and I think they'll go on till they're blue in the face attacking it, but I think it's important.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think something that we can learn from the past and from history is that nothing is foretold. When I was a student at the university, Marxism was all the rage, you know? So there was this idea that history followed a course, no? There was an arc of history, no? So from the past we were to the future, from slavery and savagery we went to feudalism, capitalism, and on to communism and universal happiness, no? This is a Christian idea of the apocalyptic idea of the future, no? And when you study history carefully, you realize that nothing is foreseen, that everything depends, that the history is a kind of weather system where very small elements can determine huge influences. This is quite disturbing, no? Because we need to think that great results come from great causes, from great reasons. No, there was a kind of physical balance between cause and effect. But actually, in reality, when you pay attention to history, this is not what happens. No, I mean, many terrible things depend on a very small event. No, you think of the beginning of the First World War, no? Or you think of the Spanish Civil War, no? This is a good example of this, no? Because in the essentialist version, the Spanish Civil War was something predetermined by history, by national character, because we Spaniards love blood and bullfighting. This is bullshit. No, it came about in the first, the very, for many months, this is very interesting, for many months since July 36, for many months after the beginning of the war, the word war was not used. People didn't know it was a war. There was something happening, but there was no, the term civil war came later, no? So, and who teaches, going to education, I mean, all of us, no? It has, they say it takes a village, no? We need a good education system, a good public and universal and the high quality. And you need to take up your responsibility as a parent, no? But I think that mostly school and high school are responsible for building citizenship.
I think we have questions from people from the cyberspace, right?
Yeah. We have two questions that have been posed in the application. So the first one, one of the online audience members comments that in Europe, the US and elsewhere, conservative and right-wing populist forces have been pushing for a while an agenda very much stimulated by the thought that there is this long-lost golden age that which we all should try to get back to. So in many such cases, plans outlined by these forces will include a romanticization of the past or just plain idealizations. So taking this into account, this person wonders if this idea of trying to get back to a golden age is sort of a modern ill or a modern phenomenon, or instead if this sort of thinking also pervaded at some time or at some point the mindsets of classical civilizations, that is, for instance, that of the Greeks, the Romans, etc. And do you want me to pose the second question? And then you answer?
Maybe we can, yeah, I think it's
okay, best. So, yeah, the second one notices, well, one of the audience members of the online audience notices that there have been plenty, perhaps too many, articles, pieces of opinion in newspapers, books, that directly compare the situation of backsliding democracy in the United States with that which led to the collapse of the Roman Republic. So noticing this, this person wonders if we are abusing or at least stretching a bit too far this sort of comparisons. So what do you think?
Okay, I don't know.
On the idea of the Golden Age, I think it's the easier part of the question, actually. I think the idea of the Golden Age actually defined classical civilization. And most of us have been brought up with some kind of progressive ideology, the kind of thought that at least, you know, in a good world, things would be getting better and that we should be looking to the future. There is no sign, and I'm happy to say there is no sign in either the written thought of ancient Greece or ancient Rome that a progressive ideology ever had purchase. That the good times for ancient Greece and Rome were always in the past. They were always going back to the Golden Age. That was where things were good. Human life had fallen since the Golden Age. Now, I say that and it sounds pretty ghastly. The kind of surprising thing about it, as often with Golden Age myths, is that most extraordinary radical changes were legitimated on the totally spurious grounds that they were returns to the past. And that, you know, when democratic reform in the city of Athens was always based on the idea that it was a return to the great constitution of the founder of democracy, the lawgiver Solon. It wasn't anything of the sort, but that really radical change was always underpinned by the idea that it wasn't moving forward, it was moving backwards. So moving backwards, or an illusion of moving backwards, can happily, thank God, be an excuse for hugely progressive ideology. So don't always knock the Golden Age, I'd say.
Daniel, do you feel you pass?
Antonio, would you like to take the Roman Republic?
Yeah, but
my knowledge of the Roman Republic is far worse than yours. No? I think there is something that I detest about historical novels, no? Which is that they, on the back cover, you always say that this is a novel about ancient Egypt, no? And it shows how similar ancient Egypt was to contemporary world, no? Yeah. This is stupid. I mean, there is no similarity at all. I mean, it's ridiculous to say that the fall of the destruction of the Roman Republic can be like a blueprint of the decadence of the American decadence of the American Republic. Doesn't make any sense, no? History is so complex. It's like a weather system, no? Mm. It's so complex that it is impossible that the same situation can ever be repeated. No?
We tell the history of the late Roman Republic in order to make it look like us.
Yeah.
And that's, and they didn't tell it like that. I mean, I think there is an, uncharacteristically, I shall compare Donald Trump here. There are one or two micro comparisons that you might make, and you can see it's a very, very common feature of populist leaders, which is they find a way around the mainstream media and the organisation of the state. You know, this isn't rocket science, but they do. We know that Trump used Twitter very much in that respect. He is unable to directly communicate with the American populace outside the mainstream media. It would not be entirely foolish, though not necessarily true, it would not be entirely foolish to say that Julius Caesar had done that 2,000 years earlier. He found a way around the mainstream media. But I think that's about as far as I'm prepared to go on the similarities.
Yeah, we'll finish soon, but just one very brief comment. You know, it seems that today we do participate in this that I think it was Sigmund Bauman who called it retrotopia. So in the sense that utopia is no longer in the future, you know, as it used to be in modernity, but in the past, it's like Trump and his followers. So make America great again. So it was great. Yeah. You know, in the past, so we have to return.
Same with Brexit.
Same with Brexit. Exactly. So it's this idea of getting back to a better place within time, and I think this is a radical split from the modern tradition. Well, you know, utopia was always in the future, something that we had to fight for, so not something that we had to recover. Right.
So there has always been a tension between both. Tendencies, no? Between looking backwards and looking forward, no? I mean, you think, for example, in the 19th century, no? All the nationalism was invented in the 19th century, and the idea was to go back to the golden age, and which what Hobsbawm called the invention of the past, no? Mm-hmm. So this is something that somehow is connected to the something in the human mind, no? This sense that somewhere in the past things were much better, no? Mm. Then came the apocalyptic Christian idea, no, of the end of times, no?
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the Christians, you know, St. John in Patmos was raging against the Roman Empire and looking forward to destruction, no?
Yeah.
But I think this is the beginning of the forward looking approach to history, no? But there is something deeply human in that, no? And that's why it's so easily weaponized, no? This tendency to nostalgia is so easily weaponized for terrible endings, no? Mm. In the best time when I remember in the 80s in my home region in Andalusia, there was some attempts to make a copycat of Catalan or Basque or whatever nationalism. And so we were provided with all the elements, with all the necessary elements. We had the golden age. In this case was the Muslim centuries, no? So according to Franco and those people, the Muslims were the invaders, no? And according to this new tendency, the Muslims were the golden age, no? There was tolerance in Andalusia. There were three cultures, Muslim, Christians, Jews, all of them were living together. That's a lie, no? Yeah. And then what happened was the Christians, the Spaniards, invaded at the end of the 15th century, no? The Spaniards, this dirty military, intolerant,
Christian,
bad-smelling, Catholic Spaniards invaded Andalusia and took away your happiness. So we had to take back our Andalusia and get back to the happy times of the Muslims, no? And this is such a romantic idea, no? Mm. And so easy to transmit and so easy to sell to people. No? Yeah.
Okay, we have to finish. Thank you very much, Mary. Thank you very much, Antonio. It's been a real pleasure.